Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Graham Linehan. He's an Irish television comedy writer and director who, often in partnership with Arthur Matthews, has created or co-written a string of successful television comedies. He's best known for creating or co-creating the sitcoms Father Ted, Black Books, The IT Crowd, and Motherland. So first, thank you for being on the program. Second, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Oh, always a pleasure. Thanks, Derek.
So I haven't told you this before, but about a year and a half ago, you caused me tremendous pain and threat of serious injury. And I have needed to tell you that. And what happened was I had open heart surgery a year ago last March. And in open heart surgery, they tear open your chest. They actually pry it open. And afterwards, even breathing deeply hurts. And coughing or sneezing is just excruciating. Oof. And about 3 weeks after surgery, I got the terrible, terrible idea to watch the IT Crowd. And it... Okay, generally, I'm not the sort of person who laughs out loud a lot. I sort of, at comedy, I smile or chuckle. But the IT Crowd, I was howling with laughter, leading to howling with pain. And I thought I was going to break my sternum. Jesus. And I'm not exaggerating when I say that I laughed harder at that than I have at any television program since Monty Python's Flying Circus in junior high.
Ah, that's a hell of a compliment. Thank you. Thanks, Derek.
Yeah, I honestly...
Sorry I caused you such pain, though.
Well, I don't know if... Yeah, I don't know if it gets much better than getting compared to Monty Python's Flying Circus.
No, it doesn't. I still remember the thrill when I first started watching that and feeling that it was like seeing something almost from another planet, because it was so interesting and unusual and intelligent, you know. I loved, and silly and intelligent is such a winning combination, you know. And I've always kind of worshipped those guys as a result. But there was one other thing that I just wanted to, a friend of mine, Chris Morris, who is... responsible for a lot of excellent satirical comedy over here. His wife actually went into labor while laughing at Father Ted. So I just don't tend to have a good, well, no, that is a good thing, I guess. But I don't know if she ever finished the episode.
I thought you were gonna say, you don't know if she ever finished the labor.
She did finish the labor, yes.
I would highly recommend that any listeners listen to the IT Crowd, except for those who have medical conditions, in which case, stay as far from it as you can. So that actually brings up two questions, and you can take this whichever these questions or whatever direction you want. One question is, certainly people who want to watch the IT Crowd are going to not be able to, or going to have a more difficult time watching a couple of the episodes because of issues of censorship. And let's talk about that. And then also, if you want to somehow work in, or if it somehow applies, how does comedy work? I guess, and the reason I'm asking that is because you make fun of a lot of things in the IT Crowd. Yeah. And comedians in general make fun of a lot of things, but there are some things that one is no longer allowed to make fun of or to even talk about. Anyway, I'm making a mess, so you just take this wherever you want.
No, well, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot recently. What you're referring to is that Channel 4 recently banned an episode I did of the IT Crowd, and I wouldn't mind so much, but it's quite an iconic episode. It featured the idea of the two men in the show tricking their boss into thinking that the internet was contained in a small box in their basement. But the kind of subplot in the episode was the boss, Douglas Renham, I can't remember what I called the characters. Anyway, one of them falls in love with a woman who used to be a man. And the joke of the show, it's not a particularly good joke, but the joke is that because of her, I guess you would say, conditioning as a man, or whatever that word is, her experience as a man, she retains that when she's a woman and becomes the perfect girlfriend for this very unreconstructed male. And that's the joke of the show. And it ends with a big fight between them, where they just beat the hell out of each other, because I wanted to shoot a Matrix style fight sequence with as many physical jokes as I could get in there. Recently I got an email from Channel 4, and it was along the lines of, well, we're sorry about this. We thought about asking you to edit it, but because it's written in such a way that the strands are intertwined, we have to take the whole show off the air. And they said, there's two reasons for this. And they gave me two reasons. And the first was, they said, we now know that trans people are at risk of physical violence more than any other group, something like that. And the second was, people watching the show may not think that Channel 4 believes that trans women are women, right? So I wrote back and I said, well, first of all, trans people are the safest demographic in the UK. As you and I know, Derek, the reason that there's this fantasy of a murder epidemic against trans people is because they took the stats for Brazilian transsexuals who often work in the sex industry, where the murder rate is just crazy because the sex industry is extremely dangerous, especially there. And they extrapolated that over the entire world. You know, so there's this kind of vision that very well-meaning people like these Channel 4 people have, that trans people are basically being hunted through the streets. And it's nonsense. As I say, they're the safest demographic in the UK. So I said, first of all, your first fact is not true. This is Stonewall teaching coming through Channel 4. And I said, I'm not going to accept anything from Stonewall, because I'm not going to forgive them for what they did to me and my family. Because 3 years ago, myself and members of the LGB Alliance and a great number of gay and gay people and lesbians and trans people signed a letter to Stonewall asking them to help us bring down the toxicity of the debate. And it's since been signed by over 11,000 people, I think. On the first day it was posted, Stonewall, which, sorry, I should explain to your listeners, is the UK's LGBT, a kind of heritage organization that has been completely, I think, corrupted by queer theory and gender identity ideology. But within the day, Stonewall said no. Right. And our demands requests were simply things like to admit that there is a wide variety of beliefs around this subject, and that they all should be respected, that the attacks on women are unacceptable, and blah, blah, blah. So they said no immediately, just no. And so, as we know, the last 3 years have been spent with many of us being called transphobes and worse, and bigots and all this sort of thing. So that's still continuing, and it continued up until this letter from Channel 4, because then the second thing, their second point, where they said Channel 4 might not believe that trans women are women, and I said, but I don't believe that trans women are women. I think that statement, if taken as a literal truth, has too many consequences for women's safe spaces, for their sports, for the safety of young girls who are experiencing rapid onset gender dysphoria, it's got too, you know, there's too much tied up with what sounds like an inclusive statement. It's actually a very dangerous statement, and one which we really have to start pushing back against. And also, I said, it is also a religious belief. It's a religious, ideological belief, and you are forcing it on me. And you're saying, because I do not share it, you're kind of intimating that there's something wrong with me, that there's something dubious about my beliefs. And I reject that completely. So I told them, you know, I'll give you a week to think about it. But if you don't, if you don't change your mind, I'm going to kind of go to war on this one, because I see things like this always as strategic opportunities. Because for me, this is such a more important fight than my silly comedy shows, that I'm actually sometimes glad when things like this happen, you know. So yeah, I'm gonna keep fighting any way I can.
So one of the things I find really, and thank you for that. One of the things I find really interesting is that there is, and I mean this in the best possible sense. There is quite a lot in the IT crowd that is pretty offensive to someone or another.
Yes.
And I mean, that's, I'm trying to think, there's the time that Jen's bra catches on fire. There is the time, and I'm sorry if I'm going to spoil some stuff here, but there is a joke that basically includes somebody jumping out of a window.
Yeah.
There is, one of my favorites is when Roy's girlfriend tells him that he is artistic. And so he says to the group that his girlfriend told him that he's on the artistic spectrum. He never knew before he was an artist. And of course, it's not artistic spectrum.
Yeah.
And that's, oh, the entire episode devoted to a calendar in support of, as you say, the boss eyed.
Oh, that's the only one I actually feel a bit sorry about, would you believe? I wish I hadn't done that plot line.
No, okay.
I'll talk about that in a bit.
Except I have to say that there's the naked calendar, it's supposed to be naked calendar, but the sexy calendar where you put nerds, male nerds, faking these pornified poses,
yeah,
was a brilliant statement about the pornographication of women. I mean, that was worth the whole series right there. It was just anyway. So the point is, there is so much in that program. Or let's not even talk about Jimmy Carr or Ricky Gervais or. Yeah. Or Monty Python, for that matter. I mean, that's oh, well, Richard Pryor, George Carlin.
Yeah, yeah. Oh well, you know, I mean, the thing, one thing I think that's happened is, which is kind of no one's fault, is that because we are now all connected, our kind of identities in the form of the jobs we do, or the types of people we are, or the various psychological problems we all might have become politicized, you know, and gender identity is the perfect example of all that, you know, because all these kids and you know, 20 somethings, I don't think anyone over the age of, I don't know, 35 is doing it apart from Kathleen Jenner. But all these people now have these identities that they are holding on to with both hands, as if it's the most important thing in the world, and anything that upsets it or disturbs it to any degree is so frightening to these kids that they take it as a personal attack and you know and so on. And often as well, like that is unfortunate but halfway understandable. But there's also this, the allies disease. The allies disease is people deciding that something is offensive about another group. And they have nothing to do with that group. You know, my favorite photograph recently was a bunch of rioters arrested in Portland at a Black Lives Matter protest, not a single black person among them. It was about 25 people, not a single black person among them, you know? So there is a kind of disease at the moment of privileged white people who I think are using identity politics as a kind of a political ladder, you know? There, you can see that it's a way of getting people fired. It's a way of getting your own way at work. It's a bullying, Stasi-like policing of the internet and of culture. And it's really, really bad. And I said to Channel 4, you're going down a really bad road here. Because once you start listening, I mean, especially when it comes to trans rights activists who are basically just, you know, they're the most, they're just often very, very online people who know how to scare corporations, right? They know how to write scary letters and they know how to write them in bulk. So that people like Channel 4, they believe that they are seeing the way the wind is blowing, but it's not the way the wind is blowing. You know, the vast majority of people, as you and I know, do not believe that people with penises are lesbians, and they do not believe, you know, that we need to defund the police. You know, they don't believe these things at all. But. At the moment, there's this strange situation where the levers of communication are being held by people who are either pretending to believe in this stuff, or people who do believe in it, or people who are simply using it, as I say, as a political ladder. You know, I think basically, if you become eloquent in the language of identity politics, you can make a whole room shut up and do what you tell them to do. You know, so you know, I think the other thing, sorry Derek, but the other thing is if we don't push back against this, and it's one of the reasons why I've been in this the gender identity fight for the last 3 years, it just means the comedy is dead. It's dead as a doornail, because we will not be able, you know. I used to get criticized, they used to call Jen in the IT crowd a sexist character, you know, because she, you know, she didn't know about computers and she was naive on certain matters, blah, blah, blah. But what they were actually arguing for, they were arguing that there should be no women in comedy, because positive values are not good comedy. Comedy is about negative aspects of your personality, aspects that we all would like to change. But we can't, you know, because, you know, we're human beings and, you know, we can't, there's certain things we can change or adjust, but our true natures will, and this is where comedy comes in, our true natures will take over and kind of trip us up when we think we're doing great. You know, that's what nearly all comedy is. And so the idea that you can't have a woman with flaws is the most sexist nonsense, you know. It's just, there was a tendency at one point for men to write female characters, and all they did was comment on how idiotic the men were. So the men got to have all the fun, the male actors got to get all the jokes, and the female actors got to do a kind of a sour commentary on what the men were doing. And it just neutered them. It made them not, like, a character is made up of various different things that make someone human. But these characters, I'm thinking of one show in particular, had been stripped of those things, you know, because they didn't serve the men, the comedy that was coming from the men, you know. So you can't be nice in comedy. You have to be nasty. The show I always admired the most was in the early days when it was really what I call golden age, was The Simpsons. The Simpsons would make fun of one point of view and then they would take the exact opposite stance and make fun of that too. You know, I used to describe it as almost like a satirical nail bomb, You know, everyone got hit with it. You know, it had no respect for any. I mean, when you think about those old Simpsons, the church, you know, the government, as represented by the kind of Kennedy-like senator, or whatever he was, you know, the police were just stupid as hell. You know, the convicts were even dumber. Everyone got it. And that's what comedy is. You know, comedy is the great leveler. It reminds us of our humanity. And there are certain people now, and they tend to be narcissists, who are saying that, no, actually, some people are so special that you may not address their existence in any way, you know? And who, you know, what a surprise. It turns out to be these narcissists.
So I love all that. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm gonna come at you with an SJW response, an identity politics response, and say, you can only say that. And you need to know, I don't subscribe to this position.
No, I know that, Derek.
but you need to understand that you have a position of power as a white male in society, and comedy can only laugh up, which means you, as a white male, don't get to make fun of anyone because I'm at the top, which means that when you're making fun of someone, you are oppressing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, like I grew up in Ireland, and when I was a kid, you know, I would be fairly wounded by buying British comics, and they always had Irish jokes in them. Did you hear about the Irishman who did this? I don't know what the equivalent is over there, Derek, but in the UK, Irish jokes were jokes about stupid people, you know, and it was hurtful, you know, and they eventually kind of stopped it, you know. And the reason they stopped it wasn't because necessarily the jokes themselves weren't funny. It was because it was just lazy. It was just a lazy thing to do. And the thing I'd argue is that, except possibly with the boss-eyed thing, which I really don't like, I'm never lazy. I do my best to make sure that jokes, they work on a certain level. Like, it's the reason why you only rarely hear complaints about my stuff, you know? I like when I'm making fun of Jen, it's not because I don't like her. I love her. I love Richard. When Richard was being bullied in one episode of the IT Crowd, I had to take a while to collect myself because I was so upset. I was looking at the monitor and I was in tears because I found it so horrible, the idea that anyone would be nasty to Moss. But you know, it doesn't stop me from giving him stupid lines and things to say and having terrible things happen to him, because, you know, the other thing it does actually, Derek, is it actually increases your empathy for people when you see them doing something that's kind of dumb that you would do too. Like, you know, the way Jen says, I don't want anyone to put me on a pedestal. I think it's Jen who says that, you know, because she's misheard the phrase throughout her life, and she's never really understood it. So she thinks it's pedestal instead of pedestal. And that's something we've all done, you know. I even after I learned the correct way to pronounce it, I used to say hyperbole instead of hyperbole. You know? So these are things that connect us to each other, you know? They connect us to each other in a more healthy way than it turned out the internet has connected us to each other. The internet has connected us to each other in a way that has led to a kind of monetization of conflict, you know? And that's not healthy. And it's really killing us, I think, in so many different ways. But humor, you know, a sitcom that people regularly sit down to watch together It's another healthy form of telepathy, where we connect with each other and we understand that we're all human, you know. And as I say, there's a certain group of privileged, you know, allies who are making it impossible for us to have that kind of telepathy.
So, I love to make jokes in my work too, and I've put myself in the position of how would I feel if the jokes were about me in a way. In a moment, I'm going to ask you to define identity politics, because you've mentioned that phrase a couple of times. Mm-hmm. But I've tried to think, what would I think about if somebody made fun of some way that I was a member of a special class? And I actually have a pretty good way that I think in retrospect is kind of funny, which is I have Crohn's disease. So you could say that I have that infirmity, that disability. And one of the effects of Crohn's disease is constant diarrhea. And I wasn't.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, thanks.
Sorry. Jesus, that's terrible.
Oh, it's fine. So in college,
you're doing fine though. So far, we're gonna get through it.
In college, I was an athlete, and diarrhea. How do I say this? Changes the soundscape of the locker room. And you're laughing already. See, you're oppressing me. Right. So anyway. My best friend on the track team came up with a nickname for me, which was Kid Kaboom. And okay, I have to admit two things. One of them is, at the time, I was annoyed.
Yeah.
And two, 40 years later, I think it's a riot.
I think it is funny. It's a good name. Is your friend? But was he a friend? Were you? Was he? Did he say it kindly?
Oh yeah, he smiled when he said it. But in any case, my point is that he was making fun of my infirmity.
Yeah.
And he was a friend. And as you said, you know, I'm not going to say we bonded over the name Kid Kaboom, but I still can't say it 40 years later without laughing.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, there are certain things. There's certain, like in the UK, there was once a period where all these new young comedians were coming up, and suddenly all the old comedians who had been on television since the 70s began to look a bit tired, a bit old, and unreconstructed. You know what I mean? They were still doing jokes about black people and all sorts of things. It was kind of like a natural, it was like, as I say, the way Irish jokes disappeared from comics. It was kind of like a natural thing. People began to get just a bit embarrassed about it. And they began to realize, oh, okay, this guy's impression of a Jamaican isn't really, it's okay, but it's kind of mean, and he seems to fall back on it a lot. And, you know, for me, a lot of the time, I would often get angry at not the fact that these were offensive, but I would get angry at the kind of hackiness of it, you know? And that stuff has its own built-in self-destruct button, because eventually another generation will come up and you will just look bad next to it, you know? That's always been a natural progression, or a wave coming in and then another wave coming in, you know? The old way of going out, terrible metaphor, but you know what I'm saying. But that's been replaced recently, and it's been replaced by, and if I can use this as a way of going, answering your question about how I would define identity politics, it's been replaced by a lot of white people using the experiences of black people and trans people and any minority they can find to shut people up that they don't like, you know, and to exercise a bit of kind of narcissistic power over people and things. Like the IT crowd thing, I know the reason that happened. That didn't happen because a bunch of people just naturally decided to write in. That happened because I'm, you know, J.K. Rowling has taken some of the heat off me, but up until she stepped in, I was public enemy number one as far as trans rights activists were concerned. So of course they're going to write letters to Channel 4, and it's just because, you know, they don't like me. They don't like me talking about this stuff, and they want to try and do everything they can to shut me down. This was just one further example, you know. So that natural order of things, where new bunch of comedians come up, slightly embarrass the old bunch, you know, or make the old bunch kind of realize, oh, I have to adapt, or these guys are going to leave me in the dust. That's kind of going now, you know. I see it in the faces of even the toughest comedians, Bill Burr, Seinfeld, all these guys who are used to tough crowds, you know. And they just don't know how to do comedy in front of college audiences, because college audiences are so fragile. These kids have been brought up to think that words are violence, and you can't say this, you can't say that. How do you deal with that? You can't, you know. You just, like Seinfeld answered it by, he just doesn't do colleges anymore. How sad is that, you know?
Yeah, Bill Maher had a joke about how, Chris Rock, Larry the Cable Guy, and Seinfeld no longer do colleges. And so he said something, his joke was something like, a Jew, a black person, and a redneck walk into a college campus and they can't wait to leave.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And
so a couple questions. One of them is, do you think All in the Family could be made today?
Well, that's, I think All in the Family was based on a show over here called All in the Family. Was it called All in the Family? The character over here, the Archie Bunker character, was called Alf Garnett. And it's an interesting one, that, because that was the show was written by a Jewish writer who didn't believe a single word that Alf Garnett was saying. He was liberal socialist guy. And he created Alf Garnett as a big kind of a, I don't know what you would call it, a whipping boy, I guess, for these right-wing ideas. And the actor who played Alf Garnett, he did the role on stage, and he was very disturbed by the fact that the audience were cheering on stuff that was supposed to be funny, that was supposed to be the opposite to what you're supposed to believe. So while it was written for a certain, you know, from a certain ideological standpoint, the audience took it on a completely different standpoint. I was watching, I've seen that happen. I've cut jokes out of my own shows where I felt that the audience were laughing for the wrong reason, you know? And I heard, it was a very interesting thing on David Letterman talking to Dave Chappelle on Letterman's recent series. Because I love Chappelle. Every time I watch Chappelle, I feel like I'm free, you know, because he really does not give a damn about these people, and he says what he likes, and it's a wonderfully liberating thing to watch his stand-up. But Chappelle revealed the reason why he very famously disappeared from Chappelle's show. And it was because he was doing some act about racism. He was doing some routine about racism, and he heard the wrong sort of laugh from one of the crew. And something clicked inside him. And soon after that, he left the show, and, you know, and the rest is history, you know? So there is a kind of a thing. There is a kind of a, that kind of show, that kind of All in the Family type of show, it just has to be written in a smart way to be, so that people are aware of these currents, these possibilities. You don't want to get the wrong kind of laugh. I think they actually did it very well in Community with Chevy Chase's character, who is a very boorish, middle-aged white man in the classic negative way, vaguely racist, homophobic, all those other things. And they handled it really well, you know? They still made him a likable character, still as human as all the others, but says dreadful things. says dreadful things. And, you know, because of the context of the show, which is very diverse, it worked. So I do think, when you say, would it be possible, I don't think anyone would want to make All in the Family anymore. But I do think it's important. I think it's vital now that we grasp the nettle and we make comedy about this super fragile generation, you know, who have just forgotten many of the most important aspects of being human, you know.
How do we do that?
Well, I'm trying at the moment. I've written a sitcom, and I don't want to say too much about it because part of why I like it is it does that. I'm trying to dive right into it. If you ever saw Larry Sanders did it very well. Larry Sanders handled race very well. You know, and the way they did that, it was very interesting. They you know, Gary Shandling would speak to his actors and ask them to put into the character certain things that were actually true of themselves. So the black woman who played his assistant, she's a practicing Christian, I think, you know, and that made it into the show, you know. And if you're a practicing Christian and you have a line about it in Larry Sanders, there's going to be a joke about it, and it's going to be a pretty good and cutting and sharp joke. And that's what was great about it. They never shied away from the pain, you know. I don't know if you're a fan of Larry Sanders. It's one of my favorite sitcoms of all time. But one of the greatest things about it is you can tell that there's a deep well of pain inside the character, because he can't help himself from making inappropriate jokes. He's a stand-up, he's a talk show comedian, and it's part of the reason why he's a great host. But it's also something that stops him from getting close to people, because they'll be telling him about a dead relative or something like that, and he'll slip in a line just because it occurs to him, and he's like that. He's got the same impulse control problems that I have. You know, it's I my worry, when you say would they make All in the Family now, my worry is that they wouldn't make Larry Sanders now. That I would find frightening, because again, there's few shows that showed that connection that we all have, even the most disparate people. You know, as he often said, it's about people who love each other and they can't tell each other, and it really was, you know. But that show might be. There was one moment I'll always remember where he's arguing with his assistant, who, as I say, is a woman of color, and he says something like, "Oh, come on, give me a break. We gave you OJ," something like that, you know. And she goes totally cold, and he goes, "Was too far." He's suddenly terrified because he realizes that he's really stepped over the line, and it's moments like that again that I just think, yeah, this is what being human is about.
So you talked about whether, or you mentioned, you know, can comedy survive this, and help me out on, I'm going to ask a terrible question and just help me and make it a better question with your answer. But so can comedy survive? And then you had this line about the jokes are cutting, and I'm thinking about, you know, at colleges, and you know, I don't know if they do this in the UK, but in the United States, they have colleges where if somebody is giving a talk that makes people nervous, they have a room filled with videos of puppies and plush toys where they can go to their safe space. Mm. And I remember when I was in college, Edward Teller came to, Mr. H-Bomb came to give a talk at my school, and it was required attendance. And I remember the next day in one of my classes, we had wonderful debates with the teacher saying, okay, some of you don't like him. Tell us why you don't like him. And we don't care if you like him or not, but you have to defend your position. We didn't have safe spaces. And I feel like an old geezer saying all this, but, but all those questions, plus what is the role of comedy in, you've talked about intimacy. What is the role of the proper role of comedy also in social change? Sorry if I'm throwing too much at you.
Well, the safety thing is a good, is a good, is a good way into this, because one of the reasons why there are so many cancellations of comedians and comedy writers and whoever it happens to be is because to be effective as someone who is creating comic material, you have to skate along the edge of what is acceptable. You know, you have to poke at things that you're not supposed to poke at, you know, and sometimes you make mistakes. Sometimes you go a little bit too far, and you like Gary Shandling did in that scene I told you about, you know. Like I don't, this kind of reminds me of another story which is slightly connected. You may or may not know of this one. The absolutely extraordinary thing that happened. But the thriller writer, I can't remember his name now. It's jumped out of his head. He wrote Devil in a Blue Dress and Easy Rollins. Let me just look up his name very quickly. Walter Mosley. Walter Mosley was working on a crime show in America, and he was telling the writer's room about, who were much younger than him, about an incident with a policeman that he had. And as he was telling this story, he was saying what the policeman said, and he used the N-word, right, to explain what was going on, you know? And then he found out later that one of the writers had complained about him. He was like literally telling him a story of his own experience of racism in a show about fucking cops, you know, in a show about crime, and one of the writers complained. So the thing that these safe spaces that we're old geezering about is that they are creating a super fragile generation who simply can't deal with the real world. They have no way of handling the things that happen to everyone in the course of our lives, you know?
So a couple of things. One of them is, I know in my own writing that worrying about audience response, I can temper stuff down later, but when I'm actually writing an early draft, and I say this to my writing students too, I cannot think about anybody's response. The only thing I can think about is, do I make this as true as possible? How do I say, and you know, later on I can say we need to take out this, we need to cut off some of the edges, mm-hmm. but it is absolute death for my creative process to be worried about audience response at nearly every step of the way. And first off, is that true for you too?
I always have an audience in mind.
Yes, absolutely.
But I don't write, I mean, I'll definitely write jokes that I know, oh, this won't make it in.
You know? Okay, here's the thing, is the best line I wrote in my 20s was about high jumping and about how when you approach the bar, you have to be running as fast as you can, except if you're running too fast, then you get out of control on the corner. There's a small J right at the end before you jump. And my best line in my 20s was, you have to approach the ragged edge of control where instinct and euphoria set you free from time and consciousness.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Thank you. And it's, for me, writing is the same way, that it's exactly what you're saying about, I want to approach that edge of control. And yeah, there are plenty of times, both in person at talks and in writing, where it's like, you know, I think I went over that line. But you can't be worried about going over that line as you're writing it. You can't.
There's a Kurt Vonnegut short story about an equal society. And the equal society has been created by if you're good at the high jump, they tie blocks to your legs, you know. And if you excel at one particular thing, they give you some sort of handicap that brings you back down to everyone else's level, you know. And it's a really neat story. I've never forgotten it. But that's kind of, I think, what's happening at the moment. And another thing that occurred to me recently, I said this elsewhere, but I worry a little bit that we are becoming herd animals and pack animals because of the internet. I worry that it is becoming impressed upon us. Like, for instance, you see the J.K. Rowling, we sent out a petition for people to sign to support J.K. Rowling. J.K. Rowling has said nothing controversial, we know this, but for some reason it's become an accepted thing that she's somehow a monster. Even Saturday Night Live recently made some reference to her, as if she's done something wrong. No one can tell you the things she's done that are wrong. No one can actually pull out the quotes and say, this is bigoted what she said. No one can find them. You know, the only thing they have are blog posts written by someone else who's decided that they're bigoted, you know. Now, that suggests to me that we may be evolving because of the internet into a group of people who are like the people in the Kurt Vonnegut story, who are walking in lockstep, who are just making sure that they don't stand out, that they don't say anything that might get them in trouble. I noticed, talking about gender ideology to people who aren't committed to the other side, who aren't trans rights activists, that they simply refuse to talk about it. They just won't talk about it. It's the most extraordinary thing. I've never seen anything like it. You know, often I'll get letters from people who are criticizing me for one thing or another, and they'll end it by saying, "No need to reply to this." And it's because they're scared. They're scared of absorbing information that might make them question it, and then they won't be part of the herd. And when you're not part of the herd, the pack animals, they come for you, you know. So I think it's I think the internet, whereas at the beginning of it I was so excited, I really thought we would see so many breakthroughs, and there's still great things. The fact that we can have this conversation is wonderful, you know. Face to face, and you know, across time zones, you know, it's amazing. But at the same time, I worry that we are evolving. Our brains are evolving. What is the effect of so much porn on young men? You know, I think it's the increased amount of autogynephiles. You see, what is the effect of all this pain that young girls are absorbing from other? You know, young girls are very empathic. I can't remember how to pronounce that. And they are seeing all the pain in the world delivered to their phones every day, you know. And I always say boys should not be seeing so much porn and girls should not be seeing so much pain. You know, it's changing us. It couldn't not be changing us. So yeah, I can't remember where I began with that, but... But it does worry me. It worries me that we're evolving into something else.
So we just have a couple minutes left. And before we wind down completely, there's something else I want to bring up, which is that I am really concerned about the notion that if some writer, that one line will be taken out of a writer's book, like J.K. Rowling, the most recent one, and taken out of context and spun into something else. And we see this everywhere with the whole cancel culture, that I am not saying that there aren't heinous people, there certainly are, but there are also this, if you're not 100% with this, okay, I was just at the post office yesterday chatting with the clerks about the US election. And one of them said to me, one of the things he hates about modern politics is if you're on the other side, I can't agree with anything you say. And if you're on my side and you say one thing I disagree with, that means I have to hate you now.
Yeah, it's crazy.
This is the guy, this is the post office guy. This is not a really politicized person. This is not somebody who has felt the wrath of the trans movement.
Yes. Yes, it's so true. It's so true. It's like the tribalism is out of control. One of the good things that has come out of all of this for me is that I now know a lot of conservatives, you know? I don't think I know many Trump voters, but I know a lot of people who vote conservative in the UK, you know? There's many forms of conservatism in the UK, you know? There's a kind of good tradition of conservatism, which is all these people who, yeah, they were kind of brought up to believe they were born to lead, but once they achieved that, they actually took care of the country and they actually tried to do, you know, the best for the country. And then there's the other kind of middle managers who are coming up now who are far less inspiring and much more worrying. But when I speak to conservatives over here, you know, the thing that unites us all is a deep concern for what's happening to, for instance, young women who are taking testosterone and changing their voices and their faces, and you know they are going down a road that is very fashionable at the moment, and I guarantee you will not be fashionable in a few years. You know, it's a trend. It's a really damaging trend. In the UK, we have a trial that's coming up soon. Keira Bell is taking the Tavistock to court because she feels at 16 she was too young to make the decision, and now she does look like a boy. She has a boy's voice and so on. You know, and you know the to me that transcends politics. You have to protect these kids. You know, you have to stand up for them. And you have to try and stop people from going down a road that they're most likely going to regret, you know. So I'll tell you, actually, I heard some good news today, Derek. This is not on comedy or tribalism, but it's definitely worth mentioning. Apparently, in Sweden, there's been 3 documentaries about the kind of trans phenomenon, and the first 2 documentaries were very critical of what was happening and very shocking, you know, shocking to the Swedish audience. The amount of young girls, they just did the 3rd documentary, and they said in the documentary that since those first 2 programs, the amount, and those 2 programs were followed by a week of intense discussion on news programs and current events programs. They really, really investigated it. They talked about it, you know. And since then, the amount of young girls going into these clinics has gone down by 2/3. Huge drop. I think 60%, 65%, something like that. Huge, huge drop, you know. So it just goes to show that once you actually drag this stuff into the light, which they are terrified of happening, it's why they go after J.K. Rowling, it's why they went after me, it falls apart, you know? And I just think, I don't know why I got onto that, the tribalism. Yeah, so, you know, I think now we're in a stage where, you know, both conservatives and progressives like myself want the same thing. We just want to talk about it. We want to talk about it. And we are being opposed in this, not by conservatives, but by left-wing identity politics allies, you know, who are doing everything they can to muddy the water, to call us Trump supporters, to do whatever they can to make the conversation not happen. So, yeah. So I've kind of grown a little bit in terms of the way I see the other side now. I used to be just like the people who are now attacking me, in the sense that I thought conservatives were kind of evil, you know. Because of climate change denial and stuff like that, you know.
So we really are running out of time. And I think the last thing is, can you comment for 30 seconds or so on the importance of writers or anyone, the importance of discourse for making best decisions for society, and the importance of robust discussion and the importance of comedy in robust discussion of the important issues of the day and the deleterious effect that cancel culture has on robust discussion. Yeah, so can you do that in 25 seconds?
Well, there's a great quote, I can't remember who said it, but someone said, literature is news that stays news. You know? And I think that's possibly true of a lot of different forms of narrative art. But if we're not allowed to tell the truth, that will no longer be true. Literature will not be news. Literature will just be, at best, a record of a really bad time, but only in the sense that its artificiality and its fakeness reflects the time. We want to keep producing art that enriches our lives and our understanding of the time we live in, and that the avenues to do that are being closed off one by one. If we don't stand up against it, one of the joys of being human is just going to disappear. And we will become the herd.
That would be a great place to end, but I thought of one more thing,
yeah,
which is that, Emma Goldman famously said, if I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution. Emma Goldman famously said, if I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution.
Yeah, yeah.
And I actually don't like dancing, but my version of that is, if I can't laugh, I don't want to be part of your revolution.
Yeah, yeah, me too. That's what it is. There's a guy over here, Sam Smith. He's a pop musician, and he said he's non-binary. And the only sign I can see that he's non-binary is that he said he's non-binary. There's nothing else. Apart from everything else, he just looks like me. And the idea that I can't laugh at narcissistic pop stars, it's crazy. It's crazy. That's one of the joys of life. I used to, every time me and Arthur, when we were writing Father Ted, because Sting was quite famous at the time, Sting would come on TV and Arthur would always say, I bet he takes his shirt off. And he always did. It's crazy how much Sting used to take his shirt off. And the idea that we can't make fun of this kind of behavior now. No. It's not going to happen. I'll do it even if I have to do it to one person.
Well, thank you so much for your work in the world. Thank you so much for your courage. Thank you so much for nearly injuring me 2 years ago or a year and a half ago. Yeah. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Graham Linehan. This is Derek Jensen from Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.